Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Making Of. I'm your host, Mike Valinsky, and today I'm excited to welcome Skip Levsay, CAS. Skip is an Oscar-winning sound editor who has shaped sound on an incredible list of films, including The Color of Money, Raising Arizona, Goodfellas, The Silence of the Lambs, Cape Fear, Malcolm X, Casino, Fargo, The Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men, I Am Legend, Gravity, Birdman, The Hunger Games, Roma, Uncut Gems, A Quiet Place Day One, and Marty Supreme, to name a few. I thought we could have him on to talk about his career, his work on a few films, including Marty Supreme, and much more. However, before we dive in, we'd like to thank our friends at AJA Video Systems for all their support on this podcast. If you're working in the industry, check them out at aja.com. Also, thanks to our friends at Zeiss. Zeiss makes amazing lenses for cinematography used on many of today's top films and TV shows. Check out all their glass at zeiss.com/cine. And thanks to Broadfield Distributing. Broadfield offers tons of solutions for both production and post. You can browse all their products at broadfield.com. And thanks to OWC. OWC offers some of the finest storage solutions in the business. Check them out at owc.com. Now on to the main show. Skip, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Right off the bat, I want to say congratulations on your upcoming CAS Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, thank you very much. It's an amazing honor, and I'm still a little bewildered by the prospects of being part of that team, part of that list of all-star mixers.
I just have to say it's warranted, it's deserved. And, you know, as I was making a few notes here for our chat today, which again, really appreciate you taking time to talk with us. I've been listening to your work all my life and movies I've watched again and again and again, movies that have inspired me, entertained me, moved me since as far back as I can remember. Not to quote Goodfellas, but as far back as I can remember, I've been listening to your work and all my friends and people I've collaborated with. So honestly, thank you for doing what you do because you've helped make cinematic history.
Wow, that's heavy. First off, happy to be the lucky one, to be in the right place at the right time, to meet the Coens and to be here when Scorsese came back to New York and meet the meteor Spike Lee on the way up and become really good friends with Jonathan Demme. And I've been really, really lucky. That's the way I prefer to look at it. I'm okay to be good at what I do. I guess I am pretty good. Like Joel and Ethan recently said, we're so happy that you guys are giving Skip this award because we've only ever worked with him. So we assume that he's good. We just don't know. We've never worked with anyone else. So I feel like I guess lucky and happy to be the chosen one for this long period for these great directors.
Well, they've been lucky to work with you. I want to do a little bit of a rewind here, just a couple of years. Can you just tell us for a minute, where are you born and raised? Where are you from?
Well, my dad was a student at UNC in Chapel Hill, and my parents lived on the campus with my young sister. And I was born in the university hospital there while he was getting his master's. And he graduated shortly after that, and we moved to the D.C. area. And we stayed in that area until I was 11, and we moved to New York City, suburban New York City, Hartsdale, New York, which is about 25 miles north of the city. And I endured high school years there and got into my rock band period, as we did in those days. And I wanted to be an architect. I worked as a draftsman and was preparing to go to university. And there was this thing, this oil crisis, where basically the job I was working at, I was working as an engineer, and my coworker said, "This is all good, you know, go to university, become an architect for sure. But it's going to really be bad for 5 or 10 years. So you may graduate with your degree and not have work for quite a long time. So if there's anything else that you're interested in, any other opportunity that presents, you might want to give it a think because you could do that and then go to university and then maybe that'll be a clearer path." So I met some people who worked in the film industry, and I'd been working in local theater building sets for these two universities in my area. And I had my day job. And then after work, we quit at like 3:30 or 4. And then I would go to one of these two colleges in my area. And we built sets for their theater department. And then I met some people who worked in commercials. And there was this idea that they made movies in New York. And I'm like, what? Really? Seriously? So my girlfriend's father met a filmmaker. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll give him a job. So I worked on that movie for a year from way beginning to all the way through to the mix. And I got like a very close-up view of all the different types of work that you could do on a movie in New York City. And then I met some more people and I got a job and I started working as an assistant editor. And then I got some work as a sound editor. And then the story gets a lot more familiar. Everyone went through that process. But the big difference for me was that I met the Coen brothers and they had finished their first movie and I got that job and everything came from Blood Simple, basically.
Love that movie. It's interesting. If there wasn't an oil crisis,
I'm sure I would be designing kitchen renovations or something right about now.
You found yourself on Blood Simple and, you know, I'm curious if you could boil it down. How did you learn that skill set? And there's multiple things one needs to do. Tell everybody what you did on Blood Simple, for example, because that's a notable film. You know, it was early days for you and you've been leveling up for decades, but take us there.
Yeah, it's I was lucky enough to meet on that first film I worked on. We worked in a facility in Midtown New York and a building called the Film Center Building on 9th Avenue and 44th Street. And down the street was Technicolor New York and the record plant. And we were surrounded by Broadway theater everywhere. And that area was a commercial center that, I mean, there wasn't an awful lot of production going on in New York, but a lot of it happened in that building. I met this guy, Keith Robinson. The editing room that we had for that feature that I worked on was in his space. And Keith was kind of a Renaissance man. He was really good at a lot of things and he was just interested in everything happening in the world. So we were editing in his facility, which had several editing rooms and they were for hire. And he offered me, hey, can you help me work on this? And what about that? And are you available? And next thing I knew, I was working there on a piecemeal basis. One of the people that worked there was a producer named Mark Silverman, and he worked on Blood Simple and the production in Texas. And when he came back to New York, he said, hey, you know, they're editing right down the street here over in Times Square. Would you like me to introduce you to the Coens? And I said, absolutely, let's do that. And they were two nice young boys who were living in New York City. They were editing an even more famous film building right in Times Square. So we hit it off. And by then I had learned enough about sound to know the basics. And I hired a couple of coworkers and we just kind of plowed through. But we did it in an unusual way. We had an arrangement with a mixer named Mel Zelnicker. He worked at Sound One in New York. And the Coens got a super deal with Mel and Sound One if we would just follow Mel's schedule. So when Mel wasn't busy on some other paying job, we would jam in there for a day or two and work on a reel and or maybe review something that we'd already done and fix some things. So we had a long 6-month period, basically, where we edited during the day and mixed at night, essentially. And the movie was quite a bit longer, actually, than the version that you've probably seen. And we refined it basically until we all agreed that we'd done enough damage and it was time to let it go out into the world. And we had a couple of key screenings and I think it showed at the New York Film Festival. It had a happy beginning and a happy premiere period. And Joel and Ethan were so excited. And it was such a kind of a breakthrough idea to have a quiet little New York crew put together a wild Texas murder mystery. And we didn't really reinvent the wheel too much. We just picked our battles and made some fun things happen. And really 99% of what's great about Blood Simple is the performances and in the text. Everything else is just trying to hang on for the ride, basically, I would say. Carter Burwell and I were just putting out fires, basically. But we did have a a lot of fun thinking of things and looking at new ways. And Jill and Ethan were very supportive about taking on everything, any kind of ideas we wanted to try. And Carter and I did a bunch of stuff together, and we kind of helped each other put in the missing pieces, and something special came out of it.
100%. And there's so many creative elements for that, and the cinematography and the sound. I mean, I got to rewatch it soon, but it's just bursting with creativity. And you went on to continue, obviously, with the Coen brothers for a long, long, long time and continued. I did have a question, and you've probably been asked this once or twice, the nature of that collaboration, because we've had on other collaborators, the DPs, they've worked regularly with certain directors or editor-director. What's the nature of that very successful creative collaboration that started even before you all hit the map? What's the secret sauce in that?
I would say that we found each other at the right time. They and I were at the beginning of a long path, and our paths intertwined happily over the years. We found ways to entertain each other and help each other along the way. And they were gracious hosts in that they wrote space and actual descriptions into the script about the sounds that they wanted to have. And they were very aware of what a powerful tool sound can be in telling a story. And they're very clever screenwriters and storytellers. I hate to say right place, right time too many times, but being dragged along behind that bus made my life a constant revelation of what you can do with sound in a movie. Really, like a lot of it is actually on the page, but it's on the page in a way that it's like fun and entertaining, but it isn't descriptive. It doesn't actually tell you what you have to do. And a lot of times the sounds are not realistic sounds. They're more abstract. And you find yourself piecing together things that at first seem like they're not to the point, or they don't mix together. They're not wedded to the other parts. And then if you let yourself go, you can find a way to put things together that don't make sense. And then something that does make sense comes out of that. And we did that a lot in a spirit of experimentation. And we tried things, and it is really true that if you just sort of close your eyes and start free associating sounds and splicing them together in your head, you can actually find a little trail of breadcrumbs that lead you to some joyous revelations. And I was explaining, I'm working on a movie with Joel Coen right now, and I was working on some of the sound design with my coworker, Lee Salavan, and I was harkening back to Barton Fink. So he and I went into the theater and watched a few scenes that have particularly interesting, very loosely connected sounds that are attached to sequences in a way where they seem like they kind of belong. But if you listen to them closely, you see like, wow, where did that come from? This is the joyous part of sound design, where you can actually, in your head, you can find some things that remind you of something. And then next thing you know, you're putting together a steam train, a series of explosions in a coal mine, a chainsaw. And at the end of it, you have a topper of a European train horn whistle. And that becomes completely abstractly, literally inside Barton Fink's head. He's watching wrestling pictures daily, some wrestling movies. And the camera's tracking in on his face. And you are so obviously meant to be in his head, listening, converting those sounds into thoughts and fearful thoughts at that. I don't know how I put those things together. I did have a tendency of just like listening to stuff and grabbing bits and pieces, putting them together and trying to make those pieces into other pieces, and that reminded me of something else. And I guess I kind of gave in to my weird internal abstract thought chain. It's hard to describe, but that's basically how you get to the groovy things. They're in there. You just have to get the key to the door, basically. I always say that sound design is something that you can't record. It's something that's inside of you, and you have to dig in there and make some weird associations and then like add a little reverb, maybe play it backwards. And next thing you know, you've got some sound design. Goopus. That's what Joel likes to call it, goopus.
That's incredible. It is truly, you know, obviously an incredibly creative art form where you give yourself the complete freedom to see what comes in, what ideas play. Take us there. Like, are you watching some of the footage and then letting yourself play? What's kind of the workflow, have you?
Generally, in an abstract sequence where you aren't following, you know, a pretty literal, like there's a car and then there's a gunshot and then there's a train by. Those sort of things are challenging in their own way, but they have a more kind of material approach where you, what kind of car is that? Oh, that's a 69 Camaro. It's got open mufflers and we can make some cool car buys. And we go into our library of sounds and pull some sounds and put them against a picture and start formulating a sequence of sounds. Like a car sequence like that, we oftentimes would record a car specifically, like for instance, in No Country for Old Men. I think we had 6 pickup trucks in that movie. So we went up into the desert and recorded 6 different trucks. And then we had a hot rod truck, a souped up like 4-wheel monster truck type sound. And we went at that in a very, very literal kind of almost documentary way. And that was what was missing from that movie, was the anchor, because the actions were seemingly simple and straightforward, but they were really complex because of all the weird silent shotgun and that weird cow killing gadget. So those things were the things that were kind of obvious. The gunshots, they were simple, but the real meat of it was these weird abstract things. So we had it having a foundation of a really, really dense and very dynamic and high fidelity track for the trucks seemed like a really interesting balance. But one of the things we're working on now is there's some sounds that are really, they're meant to catch you basically. So we have weather, we have some winds, we have a little rain and stuff, and that's all to sort of set the scene. And once the audience is there within that kind of weather structure, then you can push the envelope a little bit and add a little buffeting wind. Then that leads you to maybe a little rumbling thunder. Then you get into kind of a more gothic, like howling wind and wind whistling under a door. And then if you play those with some subtle mixing where things are coming and going, it becomes like a stew of sounds that constantly changes its face. And then when we have to find the creature, and the creature has to be abstract, is that really a creature? Is that just like a horse whinny? No, I hear that. That's not what a horse sounds like. You know, what are we going to do? What kind of sound are we going to use for that? And we start mixing these things together and taking one from column A and one from column B. And I was just thinking this weekend about this sound. I was listening to the sound of the cows on the farm near my house upstate. And it was happened to be a calm, really cold morning. And the cows were ready to be milked and they let you know. And they make a kind of a sad, long, moany kind of sound, which they call lowing. And that tells the farmer, hey, stop what you're doing. It's time. And that sound actually goes together pretty well with the quiet wind that I was hearing. And I connected my head with snowmobiles. I hear the sound of the snowmobile in my head and I hear the real cow lowing sound, and they're pretty darn close. So we're going to try that experiment today of trying to smoosh in the snowmobile sound. So all we're really trying to do is make the sound identifiable, but slightly more abstract, not so literal. That'll get us to that place where we're kind of break the barrier of documentary.
Skip, that's incredible. Some of the insights there, the incredible creativity that goes into it, the abstract qualities that you talked about. I want to zoom out here if we can, just for a second. If you could just tell us for a minute what basic recommendations you might have for students or people getting in the game, sound editing, sound design, creatives in that space before we need to jump out.
I would encourage everyone to learn an instrument if you don't already, or at least try to spend more time with your favorite music. I'm so frustrated. When I was a kid, I could play guitar and bass pretty well, and now I can't remember. I've lost all that facility, and I'm trying to learn to play piano, and I think that's a really important connection for your understanding of sound, is to see how instruments are put together to make music, and to listen to how the vocalists, how the human voice can marry to pieces of wood and metal and create music. My great collaborator, Eugene Garrity, who's a great jazz guitar player, and this Lee Sullivan pal that I'm working with right now, he's also a really good guitar player. I think that helps you understand what composition means. You're putting together sounds. If you listen to your average song, it might start off simply and get more complex and have some kind of a build, and then it might have a release at the end. I mean, that's basically like every car buy, every big audio event. Generally, it starts off, people like to have a build and a structure and have a crescendo where things are growing and growing, and then there's a big event. Then the air comes out and it gets quiet again. It's no coincidence that that's the way music is and that's the way movies are.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Skip, for joining us today. Truly an honor to have you on. I really appreciate your time, and I hope we can chat again.
It would be my pleasure, and I look forward to that day. We can burn some sage and have a little campfire and talk about sound effects.
There we go. Fireside chats with Skip. Also want to thank our friends at AJA, Broadfield OWC, and Zeiss for their continued support. We'll see you all on the next episode.